Hey everyone, this is Renee Ritchie. Leo Laporte is still on vacation. Andy Iannotco is undercover. So joining me this week is Alex Lindsay and Clayton Morris. We'll be talking about 9 million iPhones sold, 200 million versions of iOS updated, and some actual Mac news. We have new iMacs. This is Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 369 for September 24th, 2013. Unlock your nipples.
Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, visit Shutterstock.com and use the offer code MacBreak9. And by LegalZoom.com. Visit LegalZoom.com for affordable legal solutions you can trust. LegalZoom's not a law firm, they're better. You can get self-help services at your specific direction or speak to a legal plan attorney to get your questions answered and get ongoing advice. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the promo code MBW to get $10 off at checkout. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 20% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code MacBreak9.
It's time for Mac Break Weekly. I'm Renee Ritchie, pinch hitting for a vacationing Leo Laporte and Andy Iannotco, who refused to disclose his location. Also joining us this week is Alex Lindsay, and I have absolutely no idea where in the world he is. Alex, where in the world are you?
I'm in Chicago. So Chicago. I was in Portland yesterday, but I'm in Chicago now. So it's all good.
So you dropped in Special Forces style to handle Hangouts aplenty?
Yes, that's what we do.
So also joining us, Clayton Morris from Fox and Friends and from Read Quick app. How are you, Clayton?
Hey, I'm great, Renee. Thanks for having me on the show. Always great to chat with you guys.
Thank you for joining us. We have a week that is actually filled with Apple news. The standing joke around these parts is that Apple never does anything and we have nothing to talk about. And 3 hours later, we figure that out and just kind of stop the show. But this week, a ton of stuff happened. First, and certainly most importantly, Apple sold 9 million iPhones. Clayton, can you put that in some sort of context for normal people? When they look at a number like 9 million phones in a weekend, what does that really mean?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting because the question was, would Apple be able to eclipse the number that they made last year? I think it was 5 million in opening weekend last year. And analysts were saying maybe they'll do 6, perhaps 7. So when you nearly double the amount of iPhones in an off cycle, I mean, that S cycle, right? The 5S cycle, the 4S cycle, it's pretty remarkable that this is in a year when really, if you look at the 5S, just, I mean, a couple of new features, right? The fingerprint scanner, big deal. Some of the features in the camera, of course, but it's not it doesn't look, unless you've got the gold device, like all that much different than the 5. So it's really a remarkable number.
Well, and
you saw that in their stock too. They were up over 500 as a result.
I was going to ask you, Alex, did you go out? Did you order one?
No, I didn't. I will catch up. I'm just behind. So no, I didn't do it. I did applaud the what happened there, but I think that the interesting thing about it, I think one of the reasons that we're seeing that is they're opening in a lot more countries at one time. So I think that those opening weekends are much more impressive because I believe that there's a lot more sites that they open to.
China.
Go ahead.
China.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I think that so I think that that's one of the big things. I think that also, I think for a lot of people did not upgrade to the 5. So I think a lot of people with the 4S, I mean, I just know a lot of people that have 4Ss that just the 5 wasn't enough of a bump so that they didn't really, I mean, it had a different form factor. And for them, that wasn't enough of a jump. And really, if it was me, I would constantly be jumping from one. I mean, I'd go from each iPhone to each iPhone, but it's kind of my job. So, but if I was just doing it for myself, I'd probably go from one S to another rather than if I'm going to pick which cycle to be on, I'd rather be on the S cycle than the standard cycle.
Now, Clayton, I mean, there was a bit, some people attacked the number saying that Apple released two new iPhones this year, which is not something they historically do. There's the high-end iPhone 5S and the new mid-range iPhone 5C, and that they had those extra countries. But as far as I know, Apple never breaks down which iPhones get sold. They give you total numbers. And by that measure, it's still an impressive debut.
Right. I mean, I was at the Apple store on Fifth Avenue and not one. I asked a bunch of people in line what they were getting. I mean, they were all getting 5S's. So I'm sure a lot of those, I mean, I guess those pre-order numbers, right? So if you're ordering, you've paid your money, they've taken your credit card information, you're probably not getting it, though, until October. So you might not have been able to get the physical phone in your hand, but they're still able to add that to that number for sales that weekend? Or is it not included until your credit card is actually billed, which might actually be a few weeks? Because Apple traditionally, when they scan your credit card, when they take your credit card information, they don't actually, you know, charge you for it until it's like a few days away from shipping. So I'd be curious to know how many of those that people who couldn't get a phone stood in line. I went to the Apple store today at my local mall, just had some extra time, and I was going to just popped in there. I said, hey, do you have any iPhone 5S's left? I said, no, not a one, not a single unit of 5S's available. So I think a lot of those numbers are probably pretty interesting. I think the 5S numbers, though, we saw in some reports far outsold the 5C.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how many. I'm not sure if the C, when you look at the numbers that you actually, I mean, I looked at a report, and I think it was the numbers that I saw were something like 6-1 or something like that. And so the interesting thing is, I don't know if they had not released the 5C, if they would have even sold that many less. You know, I think that if they'd stuck with just the 5S. Now, I think that the 5C is a bigger process that they're looking at long term. It's not how much does it sell on the first weekend. But I think that definitely these early adopters that are willing to stand in line are not going to stand in line for, I think most of them are not going to stand in line for a 5C.
Renee, yeah, you waited in line overnight too, didn't you? I mean, were a lot of people there waiting for the 5C?
No, I think the 5C, because it had pre-order starting a week beforehand, anyone who wanted one could have pre-ordered it by then. So the people who went to line, there were no pre-orders for the 5S. That's largely due because some people thought that it was Apple just goosing the lines. But my understanding is that they just can't make enough and they didn't want to have it. We saw when the pre-orders went live for the 5S, I think within a few seconds, it had already shifted out to October. They just didn't have enough to supply an online pre-order. So you had to line up. And even then, I know the Miami flagship store got 3 gold models. My store had 7. There was just not enough product to go around. And that shows you how, I think Apple was really smart. And I think Alex is exactly right. The 5C is a longer tail product. It's meant to sit on store shelves in bright, colorful packages for the rest of the year so that people who kind of want an iPhone but want something fun and a little bit cheaper can go and buy it. But the 5S was really what us nerds and us geeks and, you know, early adopters want to have standing in line that first day. And that's probably why we saw the numbers.
Yeah, I agree. And just sort of anecdotally, walking around the studio hallways in New York City and so forth, and people asking to see the phones, they're really interested in the 5C. And they thought, oh, this is, and some people said, you know, I'm an Android user. I'm thinking about switching to an iPhone. This seems to me like a good entry product to kind of get my hands wet with an iPhone. And I'm thinking about getting it. And I said, really, this over the 5S? And they said, yeah, you know, I like the colors and it seems easy. So it somehow struck them as easier. But a lot of people said that to me. I was really surprised by that.
Which I find interesting is just it's $100 difference, and I feel like given the early reports of the fingerprint, quality, it seems like that would be easier.
Yeah. No. I kind of talked a couple of people out of getting the 5C, and I said, look, let me just show you the fingerprint scanner and how well this works. And I would pull it out, because to the layperson, it looks like you don't even have a passcode on your phone, right? You just sort of tap it, hold it down until, you know, you wake it, tap it, and then you're right into the phone. And it looks like, oh, that, you know, Clayton doesn't have a passcode on his phone. Now I put it to sleep, hand it to this other person as a test, and it just says, try again. Try again. And they're sort of, their mouths, their jaws sort of drop. Like, wow, that's crazy.
When you look at the addition of the activation, you know, the new activation tools that have been put in so that if someone steals your phone, they can't activate it with your, you know, with iOS 7, and combine that with the fingerprint, you end up with a really interesting mix of convenience and security that you're looking for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I spent the weekend with the iPhone 5C because I'm reviewing both phones. And I wanted to give it a fair shake. And it is a lot of fun. When you see the matching wallpaper, especially the dynamic wallpaper and the parallax with that candy-coated, to lift Dave Wiskus's term, that candy-coated shell, it's a great device. But then you start playing with the... And actually, I'm curious about your experience with the fingerprint scanner, because here's mine. I got the iPhone 5C. I unpackaged it. I went into settings and I told it to train my finger, and then I became skittish, like a little doe for a minute. And I touched it and vibrated, and I pulled my thumb away, and it kept telling me I was not holding it long enough or I was holding it too long. And it was an incredibly awkward experience for me to train, just because I kept feeling internally like I was doing it wrong. And then at the end, I forgot to scan half my finger, so I had to rescan it. Otherwise, you know, it wouldn't let me in. But when I did it properly the second time, after losing that initial sheepishness, it's just been fantastic. I touched the thing. I've got both thumbs, my right thumb and my left thumb added now. And no matter what I'm doing, I just pick it up. And a second later, I'm into my phone.
Yeah, one little trick that I didn't realize until I was talking to some friends at Apple after I was playing with it, you know, my inclination was to hit the top button on the top to wake it, right? And no, you don't have to do that at all. And I know there have been some reports out there about how exactly this works, but you just want to tap the home button just to unlock it or just to wake it, and then just keep your finger there. And, you know, once the screen is alive, it'll take you right into the phone. So you don't physically need to, you don't have to tap the, you know, the power button on the top and then do the fingerprint scanner on the bottom. You just have to simply wake it. Yeah, it's very, very, very fast. And my experience with it so far has been great. And I know there's been a number of reports, people saying the same thing. It's like they've picked up their iPhone 5 or their older iPhone, or even the 5C I've picked up to play with. And I just, my feeling is to go right to that home button now and to use the fingerprint scanner to unlock it. And I just find, and I, you know, it's funny on the iPad. I'm just like, oh, I have to peck out my password. Come on.
It's like an animal now.
Right.
It's interesting because, so of course, the minute everyone tried it, the internet, half of YouTube was flooded with people using their nipples to unlock it or their dog's paws. And it turns out that, yes, anything that is biological and has a pattern on it can be registered and then can be used to unlock it. And yes, if you are a CSI level person who can, I mean, CSI, if you have a really good ability to take fingerprints and produce high resolution photographed scans, and you know the procedure, you can spoof this ID. But Alex, this doesn't seem like the point to me. It seems like this is just something along the dial between convenience and security. And for most people, most of the time, it's still better than a passcode.
Absolutely. I think this is far more secure than a passcode, you know, unless you have a really long password, hash, which almost right. Nobody has. You know, so I think that it's much more secure than a passcode. It is. Much more convenient, which means you're more likely to use it. I know a lot of times we get into, you know, I get into a situation where I'm in production and I want to have my iPads or other things not have a passcode because I just want to be able to jump to them and open them. And the idea of being able to do this and have a bit of both, I think, has me more likely to leave it on, more likely to have it turn its passcode on faster. You know, those are all things that you'll do when you don't have to be typing, you know, pecking in a number every single time you want to open it.
Yeah, and the good thing is, too, to Renee's point, no two nipples are the same.
1 in 10,000 nipples are the same,
right? Like a snowflake.
And I'm just saying, yeah. You're not gonna. The kind of service you're gonna get after you open your iPhone with your nipple is gonna be very different than your phone. I'm just warning you in public. If you're at a restaurant, if you start opening your phone with your nipple, it's gonna change the conversation. That's all I'm saying.
It's impeccable.
Oh, right. There's also a hack, not really a hack, but there's a interesting workaround where you can scan different fingers into one slot. Apple gives you 5 slots for fingers. Mm-hmm. So you can have any 5 of yours or, you know, one of yours, your wife's, your child, whatever you want to do. But you can also scan multiple fingers into one slot. It takes a really long time, but we've tested it and it does work. And then conceivably, you could have one hand in one slot and one hand in the other slot. It's not as intended, but I think it's important to point out that biometric security, like any security, has its pros and its cons. Someone can look over your shoulder when you're typing in a passcode. Someone can grab your finger and force it onto a fingerprint reader. Someone, you know, could intimidate you into giving them your passcode. So as long as you understand how these things function, you can make informed decisions about how to use them. And then I think the internet hysteria kind of dies down.
And I think one of the other important things is that you're no longer handing a whole bunch of people a passcode. You know, I think that, you know, we have to deal with, high level passcodes all the time. And we use a program called LastPass, which we've talked about in the past. And, And one of the things that's really important there is we pass each other the passwords without ever giving, you know, one person got the password and then put it into LastPass and then closed it up and handed it to everybody else. But no one else has that password, you know, and so no one, because we don't want that thing, you know, it's just easy for that to start, you know, moving around. And so I think that what's interesting about having multiple people being able to be part of that is that you're not handing off a passcode that someone might write down that can't remember, or kids who have to write it down, or them saying it out loud when my son, you know, says it loud when he puts it in. So those are the kind of things that that we can kind of avoid when we're just using biometrics. And I think biometrics are the future. I mean, I think that, you know, this is the first step of doing it right. I think a lot of people said, oh, it's not going to work because everyone did it wrong. Well, that's what Apple tends to do, is they tend to take a long time to figure it out. They do it right. And I think that what we're going to see is a huge avalanche. I think that it's going to be hard to find a phone that doesn't do biometrics in 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, and I agree with Alex. And I've long been beating the drum of wanting to get rid of my wallet. I hate carrying a wallet. Yeah. And, I was excited about Passbook, and that kind of, you know, foundered. It wasn't as exciting as I wanted it to be. I still use it, my Starbucks app on a regular basis, United Airlines or Delta or Virgin America, or those types of things inside a Passbook. But to be able to not have to use my wallet, and then to have keychain integration within iOS 7, which, you know, Apple has pulled back on suddenly, and some are saying, well, that's because they're waiting for Mavericks. But, you know, you don't need a Mac, though. I mean, there's a lot of people who aren't getting a Mac who just want to use their iOS device for that kind of a thing. To have all your passcodes stored in there, and just to be able to know that you have that extra layer of security by using your fingerprint to unlock it, then you have access to all of those passwords, credit card payments, that sort of thing, make purchases. To me, if I could just carry my iPhone in my pocket and no longer have to carry a wallet, that would be a great day.
I'm curious, how far can Apple push this technology? We have it in the iPhone now. There's going to be new iPads come October. The iPad 5 is going to be a substantial redesign. It might get the A7 processor with its secure enclave. Alex, you think we'll see the Touch ID in the next generation high-end iPads, and maybe further along the line in the Mac lineup as well?
I think so. I think if they're successful, absolutely. I think that it opens up a lot of interesting opportunities beyond just, just the basic opening. I think that we're going to experiment with that because it's a safe place to open it with millions of people. 9 million people are now, or let's say 6 million people are now experimenting with this, and Apple's going to get a lot of feedback. And so by using it as a low level operation, you can really figure out what's working and not working about it. I think that as you have the new iPads, it'd be pretty unfortunate if they don't include the same technology on the iPads. I think our MacBook Pros are the next thing that I would love to see it in. I don't know if they're going to do it or not, but I think that starts to open up a lot of other things beyond just commerce. I mean, it definitely opens up commerce. It closes a very important loop when it comes to fraud, when it comes to a lot of other things where, you know, you add that to it. You have your passcode. You know, I could definitely see Bank of America eventually adding that. Maybe, you know, and I think that the first step we're going to see is not that it's the only way to do it, or that it is considered the truth, so to speak, but it's being added. Like it's one of those things, like you can have a photo put on your credit card, or you can have an added code. You could add this to your Bank of America, you know, profile that you have to put this in to make it work, or you have to type a longer code or those kinds of things to add security. But I think it also changes the way I think we might see some, you know, sites that are doing stuff like, so you think you can dance or those kinds of things, starting to play with those ideas to make sure that only one person can vote at a time. So that maybe they do something where, as this becomes more prolific, you can only vote on a show or on a contest once, because we know biometrically that's you, theoretically. And so I think that could be an interesting possibility. I also think it's an interesting possibility when it comes to down the road voting in general. I mean, I think that, you know, we're moving towards somewhere in the next decade, you know, starting to really get much more serious about doing our general political voting.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of issues related to that, related to access, related to people who have computers versus not, and how all of that looks. But I think that is where a lot of, this is the beginning of that path.
Well, and Apple has, Renee, also, I mean, think about what the kind of technology that they have in iPhoto and making it smarter with facial recognition, too. And you've got a FaceTime camera on the front of it. You've got a fingerprint scanner. Who's to say that Apple wouldn't employ, at least some apps could take advantage of that in some capacity, even like Bank of America, to Alex's point, being able to use both some sort of facial recognition. Look, they use facial recognition on the credit cards now, right? When you have a debit card, you get your photo printed out so that other people can recognize you and look at you and make sure that you're the right person. Who's to say that there won't be some, developers taking advantage of that?
And I'm told that, like, for instance, Bank of America, I don't know this personally because I don't have this kind of money, but I'm told that if you have a $10 million or more into Bank of America, they send you a free iris scanner, you know, to access your account. And it turns out if you have that much, they prefer you to be a little more secure. So, but definitely, to Clayton's point, I think that the resolution that we're seeing on a lot of the cameras that are just being built into our iPhones and into our machines, there's no reason why that a lot of biometrics can't be taken, and your voice as well, you know. So, we're getting kind of that to that Jason Bourne level of, you know, facial ID, voice ID, print ID, where you could theoretically add all those levels of security to make sure that you are who you are for the apps where that makes a difference.
I had a friend who used to work in security procurement, and he would always be taken around the world to see the latest technology, and they'd have fingerprint readers where you had to input your whole hand into a gelatinous substance at first, or doors would come down and it would scan your skeletal structure and make sure there was no one standing behind you. And these things, they sound like total science fiction, but when you start to think, sure, we have a biometric scanner, we have a fingerprint ID sensor in the new iPhone, and that's better than having no passcode at all. Because a lot of people, I mean, Apple shared stats, 50% of people didn't use passcode, and now everyone with a 5S, because it's cool, will probably try it. And then, you know, that's something that you are. Passcode is something that you know. And when you use Touch ID, they force you to create a passcode, because if you get it wrong enough, or you go too long without using it, or you try to do anything else, you have to have that passcode set up. And then, you know, to Clayton's point, maybe in the iPhone, in iOS 7, there's Bluetooth Low Energy, and you can already start to use it to set up some things, at least the way the frameworks are built. Then maybe you have a trusted Bluetooth device, and suddenly you go from a really insecure phone to something that's something you know, something you are, and something you have. And that's really good tinfoil hat, three-factor security, all of it on a mainstream level, which if you asked me a couple of years ago, we would probably never have gotten to.
Well, and I think that it's really interesting because it's not just getting into your phone, it's also opening files. What if you are able to attach Pages documents or numbers documents with all your budgets and everything else, and you can say, I am going to let these four people open that document and have to have a biometric connection to open it. So I'm not worried about someone hacking into their account or opening their account or anything else. The only time it's opened is when they've, you know, checked in as themselves. And that's a, you know, from a production perspective, you know, when we're talking about film production, as well as just finance and everything else, that's a pretty powerful tool as it matures. I think what we see right now is baby steps in that direction.
And they had the police, I believe in New York City, Clayton, the police made headlines walking around asking people to please update to iOS 7.
Yeah, exactly. They're asking people to upgrade, and they're saying, hey, they've had such a big problem. They have task forces. In fact, on launch day here in Manhattan, they had, I think, two police officers go to both Verizon stores, Apple stores, AT&T stores, and others to make sure that there were no thefts. So they had, I think, two police officers assigned to, like, each store to make sure that there weren't people, like, bashing people over the head and grabbing their phones as they walked out and ran away. But obviously, you know, iPhone theft, and it's a huge problem in New York City. It's been a big deal. I mean, sorry, in San Francisco, it's been a big deal, and other major cities where people are coming up behind people, you know, knocking them down, grabbing their phones, and going. And, you know, they've set up these task forces, specifically to deal with this. So if iOS 7, you know, hits the word on the street and people are finding out that they're not able to do anything once they steal the phone, they're not able to sell it, they're not able to do anything with it, then this may help curb some theft.
We actually had Chris Marler, who's in, I don't know if I talked about this in an earlier show, but Chris Marler, who runs our school in Rwanda, actually had, we had a break in and they stole his iPad, you know, from the house. And it was kind of an inside job. So anyway, but the bottom line was he realized the iPad was gone, and they actually used Find My iPhone to find, you know, to find this guy in the middle of the night in his house. Yeah. With a lot of security. I mean, there was like 10 guys with him, you know, but it was kind of one of those magical moments where, you know, the guy didn't know enough about turning these things off. So a lot of it is also educating the criminal public about what is possible and what is not possible with these new apps. But I think that obviously someone will think of some way to one up that process. But I think it's a good start. You know, you're doing something right.
It's
when
about
you
making
have
it
the
easier
New York-
to steal Android, Alex. That's the only thing you have to do here.
Well, you know, you're doing something right when you have the city of New York doing the marketing for you.
What was interesting to me is all the technology, and Alex previously mentioned the activation lock, which means if someone, even if they get your iPhone and they get past anything else, they can't wipe it and reactivate it unless they have your Apple ID. You know, if anything goes wrong, some people are afraid that they themselves will lock themselves up. But my understanding is that there's procedures at Apple Store, Apple Customer Care, to let a verified user back into their phone, you know, in a worst case scenario. But that's huge, too. And just to quickly dispel some of the other FUD going around, some people were concerned that you could use Siri or Control Center in iOS 7 to put it in airplane mode and thereby foil Find My iPhone. That's the equivalent of actually just turning off the phone. You can do that without any OS running on it whatsoever. So you have to decide, is Control Center convenient? Is Siri convenient? And if they're not, you can just turn them off in settings. I mean, you can make the iPhone as incredibly secure and as incredibly convenient as you want. And I think, Clayton, it's up to individuals, depending on what their lifestyle and job is, to kind of decide where they fit on that spectrum.
Yeah, I think so. Look, if you're, you know, if you don't leave the house a lot, you know, do you need all these extra layers of security? But if you're in a major city and you're constantly in and out of cabs and you're dropping your phones, you know, constantly in the cab. I know my wife has lost a number of phones in cabs. We were talking the other day when my 3-year-old, he has one of those little fake flip phones. And he said, "Mommy, Daddy, I don't know where my phone is." And, you know, I don't know why we have this thing because it's annoying. And my wife says, "Don't worry, son. I've certainly lost many, many a phone." So, it depends on your level. I mean, certainly if you're in a major city like New York City, or you're constantly traveling like Alex is, and you need to really worry about that, you know, that security. Oops, I left my phone, you know, at the terminal. I need to run back out. Oh my gosh, I hope someone didn't see some proprietary documents that I had for the Pixel Core or something. Yep. You know, you just need to balance that.
Well, I still think, I know Apple has already patented it or they've worked on it, but I know a lot of people get worried about it, but I really want to be able to turn my camera on if I lose my phone. I know Apple talked about it, or there have been some possibilities of the patents, and people got really scared about the idea of someone being able to turn their phone on remotely. But I think that if, you know, especially when we're talking about being able to have extra codes, like if I could put in extra levels of security, say, yes, this is really me and that's really my phone, and I would like to turn the camera on, please, you know, to see what's going on. I think that that along with all the other things that have happened so far is pretty makes it really not very fun to steal your phone.
I'm interested. I don't know if you guys saw this, but I mentioned before there were only 7 gold iPhones at my store. There were 3 at the one in Miami. My good friend and phone addict, Kevin Michaluk, paid a guy in front of him $1,500 for the gold iPhone ticket because he wanted gold so badly. I know at my store people paid, you know, a couple $100. They've been going on eBay for, I think one of them went for $2,000, another one maybe, you know, $20,000 or some ridiculous amount. That's not Apple, you know, deliberately not making enough production. That's the realities of trying to produce all these phones. But Clayton, do you have a sense of, you know, for me, everyone was making fun of the gold iPhone. You know, you shouldn't have it. It's glitzy. It's chintzy. And then as soon as they found out they were rare and hard to get, everybody wanted one.
Yeah. And I was, like I said, I was at the Apple store today and I was just kind of hovering around the iPhone table for a few minutes. And a number of people came in the store and said, "Do you have any more of the gold iPhones? Do you have any more of the gold iPhones?" I couldn't believe it. And I don't know what it is. I mean, it's just like word of mouth. We haven't even seen any commercials yet, have we?
No, only the 5C commercials.
Yeah, only 5C commercials. So this, you know, it's just pure word of mouth right now. People knowing that there's a new iPhone out, people reporting on it in the news, they're seeing it on their, like, you know, local newscasts, and it's just word of mouth. It's really remarkable. I know that in some stores they didn't even have them.
And I found it interesting. I mean, beyond the iPhone, people in my office walking up going, "Hey, the new iOS 7 is released." You know, like there was a lot, you know, it was, I mean, I just wasn't used to having, I mean, we pay attention to that kind of stuff, but I wasn't used to having everybody excited about a new a new operating system, you know, the kind of, you know, the cross section of people that I didn't expect anyway, to be that, you know, to be that excited about it. And it is, but like everybody in the office was paying attention to it, and it took, there's a lot of peer pressure to upgrade.
Yeah, I think that the iOS 7 point is interesting because I'm hearing from a lot of people casually just who aren't, you know, or who aren't techies, who have come up to me and felt the need to tell me that they love iOS 7. Now, these are people who are, you know, I mean, these aren't fanboys or anything like that. These are people who, you know, are sort of casual users, upgraded. And I've heard a couple of people, in fact, my sister-in-law, who's as far from a techie as possible, she said she feels like she has a brand new phone. Another friend of mine who's completely not technical said this is the first time that he's felt like he has a smartphone. I thought that was an interesting take on it. And he said he absolutely loved it. So yeah, I was surprised by that.
Yeah, I have to admit, I didn't do the developer upgrade. I just waited for it to come out. And in fact, I probably waited a couple of days because I was really busy. And then I upgraded my phone first, and then immediately upgraded all my other iOS devices. And it, I just think it's magical. I mean, it's like it's just so much better. I mean, now you look back at iOS 6, the interface, and you're like, how did I put up with that? And I don't know how Apple does that. Like how you go, right, you know, with an upgrade that takes something that was perfectly fine yesterday, and now it looks like, you know, chopped liver.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of things. I'm sorry, go ahead, Renee.
I was going to say, my mother updated to it. She did it all on her own. You know, I sat there in case she had a problem, but she did it all by herself. The servers were pounded, and we'll get to the numbers in a minute, but the servers were pounded. She waited, tried again. She updated, and then she said, oh my goodness, it's so colorful. It's so beautiful. She had a couple small questions, like the new Safari favorites she hadn't seen before, so she wondered how all those bookmarks got onto her iPad. But other than that, I mean, she had zero learning curve. My two little godchildren, 5 years old and 8 years old, upgraded their iPod touches, and they think it's fantastic. They think it's like a video game made into an operating system. And
yeah, I wonder
that.
I was going to say, I agree. I wonder though, because that was my concern, sort of like my dad upgrading, my mom upgrading, and I haven't talked to them yet about it. I know just other people around me in my neighborhood here who know that I cover this kind of stuff all had admitted that they upgraded and they loved it. Some were still trying to figure this out. This is new. I'm a little confused about this. Can you show me this? I had one person who's an editor in chief of a big website, and he said to me, I the only thing is I can't figure out now how to archive and these messages and et cetera. And I just quickly showed him. He said, ah, there it is. It's backwards now. In iOS 6, it was this way. Now it's this way. I've had a lot of viewers writing to me wondering how to close apps. That's not immediately apparent.
I know when I had Spotlight is hard for some people.
Right, right. So there are certain things I was a little worried. You know, I was worried that the dads, the moms out there, that was my concern at WWDC. I had said publicly, I said I'm really worried about people like my dad who are just going to not know their way around this thing. And I've been using it all summer, of course. But I haven't seen that much of a problem. Have you guys?
I've seen the results for me have been incredibly divisive. We have some people who are incredibly happy, mainstream and geeks alike. They love that it's built on a physics and particle engine. They love that it's basically an entirely gamified operating system. And other people just think, you know, those icons are hideously ugly. I don't know where any of my stuff is anymore. They've changed it for no good reason. And there's a lot of people at stores just coming in saying, put it back the way it was. I don't know how much of that is just change aversion, but Apple put out the statistics. 200 million iOS devices are now, I mean, you guys are developers, 200 million people updating to a new platform over a weekend. Never happened in the history of humanity before.
No, I mean, and that's from a developer standpoint, you know, the biggest challenge for us, like at my app ReadQuick, which we just launched on the iPhone, is we want to make sure that we're not just updating the interface and calling it a day. You know, there's so many things there in iOS 7 and so much more than just an updated interface. We've got to deal with text, you know, it's taken an even more important role. And so how is, you know, text rendering going to play in the frameworks that Apple's rewritten? There's a lot of big questions. And so here's one question I have, and I'll be curious to see, because Apple's never confronted this anymore, hasn't confronted this yet. Sort of abandonware in the App Store, right? We're approaching, I think, about 1 million applications now, which is a, you know, mind-blowing number if you think about it. But there's a lot of apps in there that just haven't been updated, haven't been touched. They're just sort of floating around out there. Will Apple still, at what point does Apple clean house, send out some sort of a notification to those developers and just say, look, your app hasn't been updated since iOS 4 or iOS 5. You either need to update or we're going to clean house, because Apple hasn't had to do a cleaning house in a while or ever, I think, in the App Store.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. I think that obviously there's a certain level of wanting to have big numbers as far as how many apps you have in there. And I think Apple's already pretty picky about, you know, what ends up in the in iOS. So I think that, that's probably not going to be on the top of their list. But I definitely, as a user, I definitely look at what it says. If it says, you know, good for anything after iOS 4, I sometimes worry about that. You know, I really want to see iOS 6, iOS 7, and I oftentimes will hesitate to buy something that doesn't say iOS 6, iOS 7, because it means they didn't even bother to go up and, you know, change the description. So it's probably not being used heavily at that point. So, I think that it is an important thing to make sure that things are still viable. I think that especially in an environment where such a large percentage of the users upgrade immediately, I think that you end up with a lot of people upset if you don't sort that out. But I think the biggest thing is you'll just see a lot of complaints. If you don't upgrade it and it is buggy, the bottom line is that you end up with very low star ratings and enough complaints that, you know, then that may clean house for you.
The peer pressure. And it's interesting, too, because Apple is, for the first time, at least that I'm aware of, some devices can't get iOS 7. The original iPad can't get iOS 7. iPhone 3GS can't get iOS 7. Most iPod touches, I think up until the most recent, can't get iOS 7. So what Apple's doing now is when you go to the App Store, it will offer to download the last compatible version of that app. And that's good and bad. I mean, it's good because you can get those apps, but if APIs have changed, if the way things work have changed enough, it may no longer function. So what Apple seems to have done recently is also allow developers to opt out of that. So that's kind of the best of both worlds. Because if you have someone, especially if you've given kids older devices in your family, or you've given them away, or, you know, for some reason you're waiting for the next refresh, you can still access those apps. And I think that's an interesting change in the other direction, Clayton.
Well, yeah, and I was pissed to learn that I couldn't update to iOS 7 on my iPhone 1, which I'm still using. That's my. It was really laggy. I was really surprised. Some of the transitions.
I'm stuck on 1.3.
You should see burst mode on my iPhone 1. It takes like 5 minutes in between each photo.
One of the things that I think is interesting is there's a certain level. I think there's going to be a peer pressure related to what I think is one of the bigger features of iOS 7 that no one's talked about. I guess TechCrunch finally did an article. I meant to do one on G+ and never got around to it. But with FaceTime audio, I think is you know, that there's something. And I think that I find myself very quickly pushing everybody that I'm calling. If I can't, I know that they have an iPhone, and if I can't get them with FaceTime audio, I'm just like, okay, you need to upgrade now.
It sounds terrific. Right. I mean, we've tested it. It sounds fantastic.
Well, and Alex, I gotta think, with all the traveling you're doing, I mean, I know you had mentioned before, and it makes a lot of sense. Like, we were just in Europe about a week and a half ago, and, you know, we were, when we had Wi-Fi, I mean, those are the people we were texting in our family, and they're all on, you know, mostly on iOS. My father-in-law's on Android, but we were just, you know, texting all over iMessage and not having to spend anything on it to let people know we're safe, we're traveling here, we're going to be home then, and be able to do that with not have to, like, launch Skype to be able to make a call. It's pretty cool.
Exactly. I mean, it's you know, I obviously, because of my business, I do a lot of Hangouts. So I do a lot of G+ Hangouts. Obviously, we use Skype a fair bit as well. But when I want to talk to my kids or I want to talk to my parents, it's usually FaceTime. You know, if it's not a phone call, if I'm overseas, it's FaceTime, because I just know that they'll understand it and it's built into the phone. And I think that that's important, where even though there were other services that were provided, they were all extra services. So you had the choice of, you know, they weren't built in. And so they're either not on because you restarted your phone and then they're not running, or when they're on, Skype, for instance, probably cuts the battery life in your iPhone to half when it's on in the background. I mean, it's just, I don't know what it does back there, but it's like running laps on your phone. And so, you know, I just never wanted to leave it on. And so having this ability, I think, is a pretty big deal. And I think a lot of techie folks won't see that that's important. I think that's going to, and not having to try to explain to them how to, you know, handle an invite from G+ or how to open Skype or any of those other things, just being able to call. I also think that it's interesting that Apple, well, the phone companies have gotten into a situation where they have two companies making 90% of the hand or the operating system for 90% of the handsets, being Google and Apple. And that both those companies are actively trying to get rid of them.
Maybe vice versa. I don't know. Today was at, I was at the mall, local mall, and there's a big Verizon store in there. There's not one sign for iPhone 5S in there. Nothing. It's huge. I'm plastered on the side of the wall. A big, big Droid poster. No sign of an iPhone 5S at all.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that.
You walk into those stores and you see that it's not only that there's no signs, but you talk to the guys there and you ask them what the percentage is, and they say, oh, it's mostly iPhone. When you're actually talking to the folks in the store.
There's a little bit more iOS news and iPhone news I want to get to, and there's some actual Mac news today too, so we can verify the title of this show is still relevant. But before we do, I believe that Leo wants to tell us something, and I think he wants to tell it to us about, I'm double checking, Shutterstock.
Hey guys, don't let me interrupt for too much, but I do want to mention those great folks at Shutterstock.com. They've been such a blessing to us here at Twit because we often use stock video footage. We use stock photos, illustrations, After Effects projects, vector art. Shutterstock is the best resource for all of this stuff. An amazing selection. More than 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, well over a million video clips alone in high def, super quality, a huge variety. I love this one. I feel like I could use this snow on an old school TV for something. It just feels like there should be my head in there somewhere. Or I don't know. I just see it's green. Okay. So that means we can then project into the green our own images. This is, for some reason, this is the kind of thing that Brian Burnett just loves to mess with. These green screens on our TriCaster. Shutterstock is a fabulous place for your website, your publication, an advertisement, a video, a PowerPoint presentation. Great place to get those images. It's a great place for, I would say, for inspiration as well. So create the free account because then you can use their Lightbox feature. You don't have to give them a credit card number, but you can go through all their images. They have an amazing search tool that lets you find anything you want, not just nouns, but adjectives. You know, not just monkeys, but crazy monkeys. Not just a glass, but shattered glass, that kind of thing. Very powerful. You also have this spectrum tool. It means you can say, I want this color palette. So shattered glass in the color green, that kind of thing. Save those all to your Lightbox. You can share them with other, you know, your colleagues. You can save it for your own use later. Very affordable, too. They add 10,000 images every day, actually usually more than that. So every time you visit, you're going to find new stuff, exciting stuff. Their beautiful iPad app. Oh, let me see if I can pull this up here. It looks like one of the best photo galleries you ever saw. But they're all Shutterstock royalty-free images, which means you can see something you like, and you can download it and use it royalty-free, which is a really great deal. Here's the, let me pull up the Shutterstock app here on the iPad. Life's Beach is one of their things. So just, you know, great for the summertime pictures. But you can see how this could be a great inspiration for you for a blog post, you know, put out the flip-flops and say, I'm gone. I'm on vacation, baby. Save them out to your Lightbox. This is just, I mean, it's like a gorgeous gallery of images. Shutterstock.com. This is a Webby Award-winning iPad app. They have an iPhone app. To visit Shutterstock.com, take a look at all the images, all the amazing stuff. And then if you decide you want to buy, it's free. You don't need a credit card or anything to create that light box and to use it and to visit and you know, search around. But if you decide you want to buy, they've got a very affordable plan to begin with. You can buy image packs or a subscription. That's what we have. And if you use the offer code MacBreak9, then you've got a 25% off your new account, which is fabulous. Here's that Spectrum tool. Isn't this cool? Just love this. Oh, and you can also look for transparent, right? So this is stuff with an alpha channel, or is it black and white? I guess it's just black and white. Balanced, bright, light. Really cool. Shutterstock.com. Please use our offer code MacBreak9 when you decide to buy.
Thank you so much, Leo. It was very nice of you to run back to the office just to do that commercial before you ran back to vacation and returned the show to us. Much appreciated. So the iOS 7 is not entirely bug-free. Any new release, especially historically, X.0 releases for Apple have been fraught with a few bugs here or there. Battery life always seems to be an issue. What's interesting with this release is it seems that some people have really bad battery life for a day, maybe 2 days, and then it becomes really good. And I wonder, I don't know if you've heard anything about this, Clayton, but I wonder if the new Spotlight process and all the new indexing and optimizations they're doing after the update loads kind of gives you a hit in the beginning and then sends you back to a better level afterwards.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for that better level, to be honest with you. I've been running around like crazy lately, so I haven't had, I want to sort of drain it all the way down, start fresh, do a full 100% and see how it goes from there, because I'm not doing anything crazy in the background, and I don't know why it would be dropping so much. So I've definitely noticed that even just in sort of casual use, if I'm just surfing the web, reading Twitter, it's dropping pretty quickly. If I take the train to work, and by the time I get to work, it'll be down like 79%. On a 35, 40-minute train ride into the city. So I'm curious what I'm doing, or if the if some sort of brightness thing or some sort of location service is hidden somewhere in the background that I'm just not aware of, or if there's an app that hasn't been updated properly that's screwed up with location services running in the background that I just don't know
about.
There are
some. I mean, there's a bug. There's a bunch of new multitasking features in iOS 7 that finally lets all apps multitask. It lets content update in the background. But there seems to be something going on between some of those apps and the API. I know, for example, Snapchat and Mailbox is forcing people to re-log in over and over and over again. And if you turn off the background refresh, that stops. So there might be something going on between those two things.
Hmm. Yeah, I know that I've become very resigned to the length of my, you know, how long the battery is going to last. I mean, I just know I have two of the Mophies, and I just think about plugging in all the time, and I don't know what I'm doing. It's kind of like Clayton. I don't know what's happening, but I mean, oftentimes I get up. I have to admit, I get up pretty early, so my average day starts at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning or 3:30. Much like not as early as Clayton sometimes, but so I'm talking to the wrong person about getting up early.
All
but
right.
But anyway, but that's my average day, and so but by 8 o'clock, if I haven't 8 or 9 in the morning, if I haven't charged up again, it's, you know, near dead. You know, and
yeah, the other day, perfect example. No, I was up at like 3:30 in the morning, had to do the show. Yep. And then, you know, I'm checking Twitter throughout the show and talking to viewers, and I'm jumping on G+. And then, you know, the 4-hour show is done. It's 10 a.m. My wife and I were heading into Central Park for this Oktoberfest event. And it was down to like 39-something%. I mean, if I didn't charge it up, I wouldn't have been able to take any photos while I was at this event for the afternoon. So even by like, 11 a.m., it was already down pretty deep. So I don't know if just me using it a lot, or if there's something else going on there.
And I also think that it might be just that I use it a lot. I mean, I spend a lot of time on the phone. I spend a lot of time using it. It's I realized I was watching my son play soccer and watching him take direction while he's waiting. He's 5 years old. And he's like a little whirling dervish, like wandering around. His arms are going everywhere. And like that's when they're talking, like he's just out there. And I was like, I wish he could calm down. And I realized I do exactly the same thing, except I'm on my phone, you know, always looking down. Like if anybody's saying anything that's not that isn't like this to me, I'm like down there, like, you know, going through, you know, Flipboard or whatever. And so I've thought that maybe it's just me that just uses the phone. The phone has become so much part of what I do that I use it so heavily that. That might be the case, but I'm gonna be getting usually I have one of each, a Droid and an iPhone. I'm trying to figure out which one to get, but I know that with the Droid phone that I'm my next upgrade, I'm definitely focusing on battery life, so like Droid Max or something like that, because I just want to see if I can have something that actually works all day.
Yeah, the Moto X like sips battery.
The Moto X,
The Moto X has been you know, real slow going on battery drain. I using iOS 7 next to the Moto X on my iPhone 5. You know, I probably about 30-40% difference in battery by the end of the day.
Right.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. And one of the things to test, especially if you're having battery life problems, is to just put the phone down and see if it's draining, whether you're using it or not. Because a lot of people get a new phone or a new version of iOS, and then we spend all this time using every new feature, and it's battery life goes down from when we used barely nothing the day before on the old operating system we were used to. And the same thing happens when you get a new game or anything else that's interesting. But if it's draining when nothing's happening, then you might have a problem.
Well, right. And the other thing is that a lot of it has to do with the communication services and so and how stable those are. The one thing I've definitely learned is, you know, if you put it in, I mean, obviously you don't want to put it in airport mode or airplane mode all the time, but if you put it in airplane mode, that it'll last forever. You know, a lot of it is in the communications and when you're constantly switching. So if you're traveling a lot and you're constantly switching from one tower to another,
yep.
those transition periods take a lot of battery power. You know, bad phone connections, bad Wi-Fi definitely affect, in my opinion, affect the quality of the connection.
Those are huge. And that's one of the reasons I was disappointed we didn't get 802.11ac, not only because I think, you know, I don't want to use wires anymore and transferring big files over 802.11ac would be nice, but it's the same as LTE, that race to rest. When the radio can power up, quickly transfer something and power down, you get such huge savings in overall battery life that I think, you know, not including the speed, there's just such a benefit to going to those things.
But we did get TCP for Siri.
We did.
That was a you know, great piece this week and really fascinating because, you know, I was wondering why, I mean, certain things were improved in Siri, but one of course the great things is TCP. So basically, if you're, you know, on LTE and somehow it drops, you're not going to lose that Siri connection, which you would always lose. I mean, God knows, you're driving around, you're asking Siri something, and if, you know, a cell tower switch up, you're likely not. You have to be in one stationary spot to get a good response from Siri for a long time. And now, kind of moving around, if you jump from Wi-Fi to LTE or to another band, it's staying pretty steady, and I'm not seeing those drops that I was seeing before.
Yeah, it's very nice. And some people are upset that Siri defaults now to Bing, just like they use Wikipedia for searches. Siri is a partner agreement system. So if you just say search for X, it'll show you X in Bing, but you can still say Google, you know, X, and it'll give it to you on Google instead. And I find that interesting because Safari is still Google and Siri is now Bing. So it shows that Apple's not afraid to sort of market their searching around.
Right.
The Apple TV also got the update, and it's confusing to me because iOS 7 on the Apple TV is called Apple TV Software Update 6. And I wish Apple would harmonize that because it's just confusing for normal people. But Apple TV Software Update 6 came out. It resulted in a lot of people having update problems, and it gave them that please connect to iTunes, which is really unfriendly for consumers who bought the device and never, ever connected it to iTunes because, you know, you're kind of, there's a legacy feeling of remembering a couple of years ago when you had to connect your iPhone that way. But very few people ever had to connect their Apple TV that way. So I understand why it's off-putting. Apple finally pulled it, I think, the night before last, and now they've put it back out again. I don't know if, did you update, Clayton? I waited until the second one before I updated it.
No.
And it went really smoothly.
I was at work and I didn't get a chance to. And then I was like, oh, I can't wait to get home and try this. And then I got home, or as I was getting home, it was like, Apple pulls this latest update because of all these problems. I was like, all right. So I thought it was going to be a few weeks till we would see it again. But sure enough, they released the newest fix with iTunes Radio, iCloud, AirPlay via iCloud.
That's fantastic.
To the Apple TV. Yeah, that's great. You know, I'm trying to think. I mean, I guess one of the practical things with that is, so you go over to your friend's house, you launch your iTunes library, you launch your videos folder in iTunes on your iPhone, and you see that you have Batman Begins. They don't have it on their TV, but you haven't downloaded it, so it's not physically on your device. You could just hit stream right there, and it'll go right to their TV, right? Would that work that way?
Yeah, absolutely. It authenticates your device and then shows them the content, which is really...
Right.
I don't know, Alex, we talk about requiring extinction level events for Hollywood to start getting it, but it seems like Apple's doing this instead of just dropping a meteor on them. They're slowly encroaching one step at a time.
Well, yeah, no, I think that both Apple and Google are, and Amazon and Netflix are, you know, are definitely pushing down this path of making it easier. And I think that the movie industry, I think, has also become more comfortable. I mean, I think that they realize that they have to keep on moving that direction as well. They can't keep on holding such a hard line because people just aren't going to put up with it. And so I think that one of the real issues that the entertainment industry gets into is if they take too hard of a line, and I think this is kind of in the soft politics, so to speak, is that a lot of people just don't care anymore about them. You know, so they don't see them as the good guys. They don't see them as the people that are providing these great movies. They just see them as the enemy. And I think that also contributes to a lot of piracy, you know, and a lot of people working around things because they don't feel like they owe them because they just feel like they're getting screwed all the time. And so I think that that's an important piece of that. But I think from a technological perspective, I think we're really going to get into an interesting position with all of these companies. And I've said that before, but I think that we're moving towards, you know, a 4K reality probably next year where, you know, suddenly you see Apple TV and And as well, you see Apple, Amazon, Netflix, you know, YouTube most likely moving to, you know, the ability to watch both, you know, VOD and live in 4K, because for them it's very easy to upgrade. It's not nearly as easy to upgrade if you are, you know, if you're a broadcaster. You know, so I think that there's a real advantage. So I think we're going to see a lot more there and a lot more original content. I think we're, you know, Amazon's now going down that path. Netflix is going down that path. And so I think that the Hollywood also understands that if they do not play, you know, what Amazon and Netflix specifically and what Google, I mean, where YouTube is already kind of going down that path, and I think Apple should go down the path, is that, you know, you'll either let us distribute your content or we'll create it ourselves. You know, and I think that's more dangerous to Hollywood or to the big broadcasters than figuring out making it easier for people to get access to the movies that already exist.
And I'll have to rely on you guys for this because iTunes Radio is not in Canada yet, so I have not been able to try it. But 11 million unique listeners on Apple's new service, and I know a lot of people, you know, thought, you know, Pandora should be nervous about this, or Spotify, or Songza, but it seems like, again, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is like Apple's 80% solution for everyone who would never be bothered to go out and get a hardcore music service. They are more than happy, especially if they're already iTunes Match subscribers, to just start using this, and that'll lead to more discovery and a lot of other things that Apple hopes for.
Oh, sure. If it's just there natively and people don't have to then go and try to download some other app to start doing this, it's a great thing. And to me, when people ask, well, why would Apple even bother with iTunes Radio? To me, it's one of those things, why not? Why would Apple want to leave money on the table? Any sort
music
of advertising
is in their DNA, Clayton.
Right. Well, why would they want to cede the marketplace in any kind of way to anyone else? I mean, yes, it may not be bringing them gallons of cash, but it's really about brand. People know to go to the iTunes store to download the latest album. That's where you do it. You know, you're number one on iTunes this week. It's the vernacular, right? We've had a couple guests on our show recently, country stars and so forth, and say, yeah, well, the song is number five on iTunes this morning. They don't talk about it on the Billboard charts. They say, we're this on iTunes. And so why cede that to somebody else? It's been really great. I'm really enjoying listening to it. And early on, I was enjoying listening to it over the summer. Very easy to use, and based on the artists that I listen to and that I enjoy, whether it's Death Cab for Cutie or something else, you know, just to be able to create a radio station around that particular artist, also be able to create a radio station around a particular song is really great, and then save them in your folders so you have access to them on a regular basis, and it's pretty fast. I was really surprised at the variety of music that they've played and things I've learned about and then ended up buying as a result, which is ultimately what Apple would love, right? If you like the song, you're hearing new stuff for the first time, and buy it.
Well, and I think that one of the things that I was surprised about, and I have to admit, I kind of poo-pooed it and just didn't. I was like, oh, I don't need that at all. And the only thing that got me really looking at it was my daughter, my 18-year-old daughter telling me, you know, that this is really cool. And when my 18-year-old is pretty, she's pretty jaded and very geeky. You know, she's had a computer since she was five and she just knows all the little bits and pieces. And for her to say, this is really cool, I thought was impressive. You know, like it was, I thought, okay, well now I have to check it out. So now I opened it up on the Apple TV and thought that that's just a great place for it for me. You know, I have a tendency, I mean, I'm a pretty heavy Spotify user, but, And for me, I was just kind of like, I don't know why I'd bother, you know, but now I'm experimenting with it because if she thinks there's something in it, then I feel like I better pay attention, because I just thought it was just, I have to admit, I was not very excited about it, but I think it's turned out to be a pretty good implementation. I think that one of the things Apple needs to do and think about is how to revolutionize discovery, which I don't think that anybody's doing very well right now.
No. And I also think I forget often, I mean, what I've even bought, you know, I'll buy a new album every now and again, and until I somehow randomly stumble across it. You know, I used to have my CD shelves, right? Like I've got like over here, over my shoulder, you know, you used to have all the CDs lined up and you have them alphabetized. I knew that my Police albums were down here next to Poco or something. And I could see it. And I'm like, I'm in the mood for a little Miles Davis and I could grab this. Now I forget that I own things. And until you're sort of searching through, I sort of stumble across them. And you're right about that. Discovery is still discovery and remembering what you've purchased.
Well, I think that a lot of, I don't think about purchasing much anymore. I mean, I have to admit that I've become very comfortable inside of the kind of the Spotify world where I just, you know, just collect stuff and put stuff in there and I have my little playlists and everything else. And I still think that there is a, I think we need to think about the new radio, which is finding new tastemakers and making sure that they find some way to monetize what they're able to do. Because someone who really gets the kind of their finger on the pulse of music is very valuable to the music industry. And right now, you know, the music industry is still, you know, 20 years behind and still looking at radio stations to be that pulse or the, you know, YouTube, you know, videos to be that pulse. But I think that there are a lot of people out there that used to, you know, that make, you know, that can make great playlists. And right now there's not really an incentive for them to do that. But I think that at some point someone's going to realize that if they made a little bit of money off of everybody who downloaded their playlist, they really, you know, and we started paying attention to who those people are, I think you'd end up with a very, very interesting, you know, explosive growth in that process. And so I think that we need to think about what that looks like, because I think that those are, I mean, that's the next generation of spreading the word, is people getting really big followings on playlists. But a lot of people won't do it that are prominent, because it's just some work and there's no real benefit from it, you know, from financially. And I think that I think Apple and some other folks need to think about that. And I think that's one of the ways that Apple could do something, could think different. You know, and figure out how to make that work is to really figure out how we're going to energize tastemakers and how we're going to really connect them with the population.
I think that's really important, because there's going to be all these complementary businesses, what Instagram did for photography, what playlists could do for music. And I know Leo wants to tell us about a way that you can actually protect that business when you want to go set it up. I think it's called LegalZoom.
Hello, everybody. Don't let me interrupt. Well, actually, let me interrupt, please. I want to talk about a sponsor, LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is providing personalized, affordable legal protection for people in all walks of life. I'm not talking a law firm. It's better, really, because you don't need a law firm for a lot of the work you need to do. If you're starting your own business, first place you should go, LegalZoom.com. Create that LLC or that Chapter S or Chapter C corporation. They even can do nonprofits for you, starting at $99. They walk you through everything. They tell you everything you need to know, which is fabulous. So you really not, you pick the state, you walk through this questionnaire, but it's more than a questionnaire. It's really directed legal documents. And if you decide, no surprise pricing, which I love, there's no hourly fee. If you decide, oh gosh, I need to ask an attorney, they even can back you there with their legal plan. They've got attorneys. They've negotiated flat rate attorneys in almost every state. You can decide on the attorney based on their profile or read unedited reviews from customers so you get an idea of exactly what these attorneys can do and how good they are and whether they meet your needs. LegalZoom's really great. And it really empowers entrepreneurs to get started. When you're first starting a business, you don't have, you know, a lawyer, but you still need to do certain things. LegalZoom.com can help you. Compliance calendar, businesses, initial reports, annual reports, corporate minutes, registered agent services. We use that because we're a Delaware corporation, so we need a registered agent in Delaware. Things like this, LegalZoom just cuts through the paperwork and helps you get the job done. For your family, too, a living will, a last will and testament, durable power of healthcare power of attorney, you need that. Pet protection agreement. These are things you don't think about. Real estate deed transfers, all at very affordable prices. That's what I like about LegalZoom. Great work, great price. That's why over a million business owners have trusted LegalZoom over the last 12 years to start their business. It'll save you a lot of time and a pile of money. I want you to go there right now, browse around, figure out what you need, and then save $10 off at checkout when you use the offer code MBW. MBW. LegalZoom.com.
Thank you, Leo. I will get all my legals zoomed up just as soon as humanly possible. But first, I want to talk to you guys about the new iMacs. Apple dumped these in a press release this morning. I don't think that's a huge surprise. Apple has done that before, usually as the way to clear the deck when they have another event coming up or something they feel is, you know, maybe more attention worthy. And it sets expectations, but it also gets products out without having to wait, you know, for the whole long litany of things. And Clayton, I know you were following, I mean, you had some mm-hmm. of the best information going into the last iMac refresh. This looks like, you know, the same form factor, but they really ramped up the performance and, you know, basically the specs inside the machine. It's got Haswell in it now, and it's got the new ATI graphics cards. It looks like a great iMac.
Yeah, it does. I mean, we're seeing, I mean, at least according to the Apple press release, until we get these out and start playing with them, they 40% increase in graphics performance, over 50% in 50% increase in performance in other areas. You know, I just got my 27-inch iMac just a few months ago, and you know, I love photography, and so this was to me like the main photography machine. I got the Fusion Drive because you know, I wanted to make sure that I have a Drobo that carries like most of my Lightroom library and everything that I'm doing there. But I wanted, you know, the Fusion Drive so that, first of all, I think it was like thousands of dollars in savings to not just have the SSD drive in there, but to just to stick with the Fusion Drive. And talking to Apple engineers and others about this, you weren't going to see that much of a performance hit by going with just the SSD drive over the Fusion Drive for those main apps. Obviously, it's moving and shifting apps to where you need it. So if you're using Lightroom all the time on the Fusion Drive, it knows to store it in the SSD area of the Fusion Drive. So I found that, okay, I'll be saving myself a couple thousand dollars here instead of going that way. I'm sure I'm just pissed that this, just a few months later, they're out with this one. So especially because it seems like the performance increases in the SSD area and the way in which the way in which it's talking to the Fusion Drive seems like you're going to see an increase in performance. And so I do notice some lagginess here and there when I'm doing certain things. And I wish that I had just waited a few months.
I think it's, and Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, it's PCIe flash now. So does that give you real world? I know theoretically PCIe flash is way better than a discrete drive, but does that give you real world performance?
I don't know. I mean, pretty much all the machines we get now are all SSDs. So we don't use Fusion drives. We don't use SATA drive. It's just all SSD because it's for us, being able to recover quickly in production. We're doing a lot of live events and, you know, a machine needing to be restarted. I had it yesterday, you know, where I'm in the middle of a live event and the primary machine, you know, has an issue and I have to restart it. It's during an event and I want that to be as short as possible. So we don't, we've had too much trouble trying to deal with Fusion drives and stuff like that. I mean, maybe we'll come back to them and take a look at them. But for us, you know, we just get, even if they're not really big drives, if it's a desktop machine, we're happy to put, you know, a larger drive next to it and make sure that it's got a 256 or 512, you know, flash drive on it. But yeah, I know we're not the normal case, but there are only a few things that just make a massive difference in performance. And once you get used to working on an SSD only drive, you go back to anything like Fusion or ATA drives or whatever, and it's just like, I don't know, it's like walking through sludge.
It's amazing to me when you look at how the Mac has progressed. I mean, we were used to iPhones and iPads being sealed computing appliances. But first with the MacBook Air and the new MacBook Pros that had sealed batteries, Apple started to do that with their computers. And a lot of us who are used to building our own computers from scratch, it kind of puts us on edge. It makes us feel like we've lost control. But it lets them do stuff like they're doing with this new iMac and with the new Mac Pro, where the SSD is no longer a separate part. It's on the motherboard, and that, you know, gets rid of a lot of latency. It's got 802.11ac, which, like we spoke about before, it lets you transfer stuff so much faster without a wire. It's also got these incredibly thin profiles. The Mac Pro is going to have the actual GPUs, two of them, soldered onto the main board. Clayton, are we in the era, I mean, everything from iPhone 5 to iTunes Radio, are we in the era of popular computing?
I think so. You know, I obviously we saw, and maybe this is telling to see, you know, it was part of the iPad event last year. It was a big deal, or at least it seemed like it was a big deal to have these iMacs as part of the iPad event last year. And they spent quite a bit of time showing them off on stage and spinning it around. I think they unveiled it and turned it around. And
it disappeared. It went sideways and it disappeared.
Right. You couldn't even see it from the side. And it was, you know, spotlight hitting this thing. And we're still working on the Mac. And obviously you see that with the Mac Pro. And obviously Mac Pro will probably take priority at this next iPad event. But yeah, I think, you know, just the fact that they issued a press release and told us that these things have been updated, obviously, how much of a market is there for the folks out there who are spending $3,000 on a 27-inch iMac? I mean, it's the Alex Lindsay's of the world. It's the Clayton Morris's of the world who are doing some heavy photography and thing. But yes, I think we're in the popular computing era. And I think you can see that in the sort of the, as some are calling it, sort of, I think you were even saying this, Renee, weren't you, like the sort of the Andy Warhol with the iPhone 5C? Yeah, the colors,
new
like
commercials.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me, Alex. I mean, some people were upset that these didn't have Retina displays, that they're not 4K yet. Do you think it's reasonable to have, you know, consumer devices going 4K or Retina at this size yet?
I think this would have been probably a little early. I think that you're talking about either increasing the price or reducing the margin for something that is still pretty out there. I think that a year from now, we're probably, you know, a year or 2 years from now, we'll see, you know, everything will be all 4K. I think that's kind of the direction we're going. I have to say that I'm still not one of the people that is a big fan of my Retina. I don't, you know, I love my MacBook Pro, and we have a lot of them. These are kind of our workhorses. I would buy them and be happy with them without the Retina screen. I know that people really are attached to their nice smooth text and everything else, but I still feel like we end up with, it means that there's more of the graphics processing that's going to creating pixels that I don't need, you know, to get my work done. So I don't feel like I'm not that excited about the Retina, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm excited about the performance and the rest of the computer.
Yeah, that raises the question. We've now got Haswell MacBook Airs. We've now got Haswell iMacs. We're waiting on the Mac Pro, obviously, has been announced. Haswell Mac Minis could be coming out. If they're not a redesign, then that's probably a press release. But Haswell MacBook Pros, which would hopefully have the new Intel HD chips in them, which would take them from redlining at Retina graphics to being able to comfortably do it in like second or third. And I think, you know, that's the machine I want. Sounds like the machine Alex wants. I don't know if that's a big enough deal to have it be in the event, but I feel like that's got to be coming next or coming soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things I'm definitely expecting to see is with this new iMac, with the Mac Pro and the MacBook Pro, I think that obviously Apple's going to want to cater towards that the professional video editors and so on and so forth who have poo-pooed them for a long time. But now what they're going to end up seeing, and they've already said that they're going to have an upgrade to Final Cut Pro, I think what we're probably going to see is them showing, hey, you can do it on an iMac, you can do it on a Mac Pro, you can do it on a MacBook Pro, and you're handling, you know, four levels or whatever levels they can of 4K footage, and go try to do that anywhere else. You know, and I think that that's going to be... I have a feeling that that's probably going to be the narrative, you know, is that by building this system that is totally integrated between the software and the hardware that is designed for that, I think that they're going to be pushing back at that market, because that, I think that is the market for a lot of these higher level machines. I don't think if you're doing Excel work, I don't think you really need any of this.
Yeah, I don't think it's a surprise Apple showed off an upcoming version of Final Cut Pro 10 that's, you know, made specifically for all the OpenCL that's going on in the new Mac Pro. And yeah. Clayton, I'll be interested to see if the Mac Mini on Haswell, because some people, no matter how nice the Mac Pro is for certain areas, they just have different server level needs. And I wonder if clusters of the Mac Mini running Haswell, you know, in a Mac Mini colo-like location will be the alternative Mac for the server areas.
Well, yeah, certainly low-powered.
Yeah, and I can say the Mini is one of my favorite. We have so many Minis, and they're my favorite little glue that I just put. We put them everywhere. We have cheap ones and expensive ones, and we have some that just power, you know, display and feedback stuff, and we have other things that run, you know, run Hangouts or run little streams and so on and so forth. One of the things we really like about them is the fact that we are able to. Put them in two of them into one U racks. And I think that there are a lot of people that value, I don't know how many people are actually taking a Mac, I don't know how many people are taking Minis and actually putting them on their desk. I think the vast majority of us are taking them and shoving them into one U racks, two at a time, and locking them in. And I would love to see a redesign that was more towards that. I hope they don't make them round.
Mini trash cans, that what you want to?
Maybe so. So sad. I have gotten to the point where I've gotten over it with the Mac Pro, and I understand why they did what they did, and they made it really efficient, and it allows them to cool everything in a central location. It allows it to make it super small, and I'm envisioning ways for us to build, you know, special kits to take them out, and they are a lot smaller, and which means smaller Pelican cases and everything else for us to take them where we want to take them. But I'm like, I just hope they still give us some kind of form factor that I can fit into a rack. You know, and I think there's a lot of people that'll be bummed if they take that away.
I will not be surprised to see a picture of Alex Lindsay on Google Plus with two Mac Pros strapped to his back and those massive heat sinks actually providing enough lift for him to get above the action to shoot the scene.
You're going to have to try that. It's That's all I got to say.
Clayton, we were talking about this before when you mentioned the key, iCloud keychain and how that disappeared after the beta before it went live in iOS. That's also been promised with Mavericks. Mavericks is coming up. I mean, often Apple releases Mavericks after their earnings call, which is coming up fairly soon. If not, there's an October event coming up. We've got AirDrop now in iOS, but it doesn't play nicely yet with AirDrop on the Mac. How much do you think we're still waiting on Mavericks before everything in the iOS ecosystem kind of gets that next boost up?
It's a good question, because a lot of the skeuomorphism still existing in on the Mac that you don't have now in iOS. I don't know. I think we saw that lag with iMessages too. Being able to communicate back and forth, there was a lot of bugs, and it seems like the team's trying to work out those issues where, you know, I'd launch iMessages on my Mac and then I'd sit down and then 5 minutes later I get another message on my phone. Then even though I had sat there and I've actually gone back and forth and answered the person, it's still showing up on iMessages on my Mac. So I
had
still
that with you. I had a phone in the corner buzzing with your messages that weren't showing up on my main phone.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, when you've got the keychain issue, I think that there's still, I think they're trying to unify these two things in a way. But I think when I look at the icons, I think I look at the, you know, just the contacts when I have to pull up that address book and it still has the old Corinthian leather on my Mac. It seems so dated now compared to what I'm experiencing on iOS.
You should only have leather on the back of your Galaxy Note 3, Clayton. It's the only place.
One thing that worries me about a lot of the integration that I have to keep kind of stay conscious of is really paying attention to what you're giving access to. Because a lot of us have we have an iPad, we have a phone, and we have a computer, and we may have a desktop computer. And when we install these, they all ask, you know, what do you want to get in iMessages? And I pretty carefully turn a lot of that stuff off. You know, I don't want it going to everything because, you know, I don't know what's being texted to me, you know, and I don't, right. and sometimes it's a password or it's a something or other. And I don't want it going to all the machines that aren't in front of me. And so I know that with me, you know, a lot of times my phone is getting my messages. The phone that I have with me all the time is getting the messages to the number, but I turn most of the iCloud and everything else. And I've been really, I think it's important for people to think about that, because I think a lot of people just leave it all on. I had a talk with someone and the company was leaving them all on and you can see them appearing everywhere. And so that's, that's something that definitely pay attention to.
Notification pollution.
Yeah, they're dinging around the house too nonstop. You know, you hear one upstairs, yeah. And you have you like, oh, there's that old iPod Touch I had 2 years ago. I found it.
Yeah, exactly.
In our moment of internet insanity this week, we had BlackBerry Messenger for iOS and Android. The Android version leaked out. The iOS version went live in New Zealand, and problems arose. They ended up having to pull it out. BlackBerry said that it was because the Android APK that leaked out was not final and caused havoc on their servers, and it's going to get, you know, done again lately. It also didn't seem to be compiled for iOS 7, so I hope they're fixing that before they release it. But a whole bunch of fake ones started appearing, and then yesterday we had a fake iMessage app in the Google Play Store. And I'm just wondering, Clayton, we're in this era now where communications are everywhere, but, you know, the Apple stuff still isn't cross-platform almost at all, to the point that people are now spoofing it on other stores. BlackBerry, which was locked down for a long time, is going to go multi-platform. I wonder how long it'll be until there's just a way for us to talk again. You know, SMS took forever to go cross-carrier even. It seems like a really hard problem to solve.
Yeah, it's a good question. Instead of having all of these different companies with their own sort of proprietary ways of communicating, I wanted to share a photo stream with family members and, just sharing it out to like 8 different family members. I've forgotten that somebody had switched to Android, and then I just got a, you know, rejection notice back. They couldn't accept it. Then this other person who hadn't yet updated to iOS 7 got pinged back. He's on Android. He doesn't have iMessages. He's on BlackBerry Messenger. He can't receive it. He's refusing to switch to this device. I don't know. I never make phone calls. So if I can't communicate with you digitally somehow, then, you know, whether it's through iMessages, whether it's through text messages, whether it's through my computer, it frustrates me when I'm like my best friend, Mike, I cannot communicate with him using iMessage. And there's a couple of other folks in my life who my friend Andy, he still has like a flip phone. When I sit down at my Mac to get some work done, I think, oh, I left my phone upstairs. I can't text him using iMessages right now. I got to run upstairs, grab my phone. Yeah, it's still, It's still a bit of a headache.
I don't know what we're going to do to get past that.
I think that there's also a protocol issue. Just the one thing I will say is that, you know, one of the things that you'll notice when you're trying to use Skype and calling out with Skype, because when people call me on Skype, you know that all the protocol stuff is not as easy as it would seem. And you add latency and a little bit, you know, it's incredible what can be done right now. And the fact that we can call the other side of the world and have almost no latency. But we're pretty sensitive to it. If the latency goes over about 200 milliseconds, which is about a quarter of a second, 250 milliseconds was about a quarter of a second, it starts to feel very slow. And a lot of times when you're trying to get interconnecting between terrestrial and IP, those latencies are much higher than that. They can be, you know, they start getting to, you know, 750 milliseconds, 1,000 milliseconds, 1,500 milliseconds. And now it starts to feel like that satellite feed on, you know, on your news network, you know, in Afghanistan. And it's very hard. It becomes very hard to have that conversation. And so some of this interconnect stuff is proprietary because it is, when we have to deal with this all day, this is like my daily, like what I have to deal with, latency and hundreds of milliseconds. But a lot of it is working with the outside networks and interconnecting with those outside networks is more than just them being proprietary. It is also, I mean, they could do something about it, but it's also figuring out how to get out of one system and into another system. And when a quarter of a second makes a difference, you know, and that is some of the difficulty.
I do know that there is one thing that is still bringing all of us together, and that is Squarespace. And I think Leo is going to tell us about that next.
Hello, Mac Breakers. Let me just mention very quickly before we get to our picks of the week, our great friends at squarespace.com. For years, we said the secret behind exceptional websites, really, it's so much more than that now, because they've got e-commerce, they've got amazing, gorgeous templates. Any photographer, artist, designer is going to want to run to Squarespace, because you may not be a web expert, you're an aesthetic expert, you know what your look is, what you want it to look like. Squarespace empowers you to make a website, even if you don't know JavaScript, CSS, HTML. They've got drag and drop. You start, go right now to squarespace.com, click the Get Started button. You'll see their beautiful 20 new templates, all of them mobile responsive. Pick one that it doesn't have to be an exact match. Just pick one. By the way, you can immediately see what customers are doing or actually doing with those templates. All of the templates, by the way, mobile responsive. That means that they look good at any size, whether it's a 27-inch screen or a 5-inch phone or a 4-inch phone. Mobile responsive is the latest in the design. Now, if you are a developer, if you do know JavaScript or CSS, they've got a great developer's platform, too. I don't want you to think you can't do that. You can. Basically, you can do anything. This is hosting plus the best content management software to create an amazing, amazing website. We're looking for people who have created sites with Squarespace. Send us a tweet, will you? Link to your Squarespace website. Make sure you use the hashtag TwitSquarespace. We'll take a look and we'll mention some of those sites in future episodes. So again, tweet your link to hashtag TwitSquarespace. Hashtag TwitSquarespace. And we will be glad to highlight it. Boy, look at the prices, too. When you decide it's time to buy, there is no more affordable hosting. This is hosting and the software. It's everything. Always secure, always up to date. As little as $8 a month with the annual plan. If you get business, you want to do commerce, and really a great deal on commerce, $24 a month. When you buy the annual plan, they'll hook you up with your domain name free. You get fully integrated e-commerce. There are no transaction fees, unlimited physical or digital products. You get a mobile store. They even do things nobody else does. Inventory tracking, tax calculations, shipping calculations, unlimited coupon controls. You come on Twit and you say, hey, let me give you Twit listeners a 20% off, use the coupon code TWIT, and all of things like that. It's just, this is super pro, super great stuff. And of course, all of their unlimited and business plans have unlimited bandwidth, which means you never get a bandwidth bill, no matter how popular you are. Go there right now, squarespace.com, click the Get Started button, import content from your existing website. They have importers for almost all the big APIs, and it gets everything too, man. Links, pictures, even comments. You'll really get a sense of what it looks like. Play with all the templates. It's very easy to switch templates and still all the content is preserved. When you decide to buy, we ask you to use our offer code MacBreak and the number 9, MacBreak9. And as a thank you, we'll give you 20% off your first purchase on your first new account, you got to take a look at the Squarespace apps too. They've got the best app developers. Just really great. Squarespace.com. Offer code MacBreak9 for 20% off today. And now we take you back to MacBreak Weekly.
Already in progress.
Thank you very much, Leo. We're going to get to our picks of the week in just 1 second. I'll give Clayton and Alex a couple seconds to scramble and make sure they've got their picks. But I did want to mention that with the iPhone launch, Apple walked out their executive department. They had Johnny Ive and Craig Federighi and Tim Cook available for interviews. They did them on Bloomberg. They did them on USA Today. If you haven't had a chance to see them, they're actually really fascinating. And Clayton, I love the way that they sort of had Johnny and Craig playing off each other in those interviews.
Yeah, and it seems that this is certainly part of a new strategy to put these guys out there, make sure that everyone sees this is the future of Apple. These guys, you know, it's the triumvirate. It's not just Tim Cook. It's obviously part of a strategy for them going forward. And, you know, I like the photos too, because it's like a fun, it's almost like a, like Friends, you know, like from NBC, like they're kind of hanging around, like, you know, in the photo shoot, they're just all hanging around on this backdrop, all checking out their phones. Like we're just, you know,
could
we're just
be having any fun. More friendly?
Right. This is like the theme song in the background. And at the end of it, they all fall into a fountain.
Did you think it was manufactured, Alex? It seemed kind of sincere to me.
Well, I think that I don't know if it's manufactured, but I definitely think that I agree with Clayton that it is a very specific goal. I mean, I think that one of the things that Apple lost, I mean, they lost a lot when Steve Jobs passed, but I think that they lost that epicenter of some of the charismatic leader. And I think that what is really interesting, and I think a great move, is to not make that charismatic leader one person, is to break it up into, I think what we're looking at here are the three people that you're going to connect to, the three people that are going to that you're going to think about who are running the company. And I think that I think that they represent three very important aspects of the company as well. And I think that it's a great move by Apple to, you know, kind of go down that path. So but it's not going to be, again, one person. It's not going to be the Bill Gates or the Steve Ballmer or the, you know, Sergey Brin, or, you know, and I think Google is actually a good example of, you know, having a few different people that we look at as, you know, whether it's Eric Schmidt or Sergey or, you know, that you have a variety of people that you think of as leaders, and it's not all coming from one, you know, one mouthpiece. So I think that I think that's important, and I think it's very useful for Apple.
Some people were wondering, Clayton, why, you know, Phil Schiller or maybe Eddie Q weren't up front and center, because they often play a role on stage when, you know, Johnny Ive is more recluse. And maybe that was part of the reason they wanted to show Johnny off a little bit.
Well, it's Apple's rule of three, right? It's like, you know, there's a great book written about Steve Jobs' presentation skills and the rule of three, why you always have three main things, you know, as part of your presentation. To put four in there, it just doesn't work.
Well, you know, three has been used for a couple thousand years. As
right. You know,
yeah, right. Yeah, right.
In comedy as well, it's the rule of three. You know, you've got to, so it just, you know, the fourth, plus it wouldn't fit well on that Business Week cover to have Phil Schiller just kind of popping out of the background.
Photobombing in the background.
Right, right.
All right, so let's move on into Picks of the Week. What do you have for us, Alex?
So my pick of the week is a program called Essential Anatomy 2. And this is something you can get from the App Store. And I can't remember. I should go back and look at how much it is. I think it's $30 or $40, I believe, or something in that vicinity. But it is, I mean, when I was a kid, I would have spent a lot of time just, you know, cutting people up, you know, of course, virtually. It's just, you know, this really, I think, is the reason that I picked it. You may decide that you want to get it or not, but one of the things to really look at is this is what our education system should look more like, you know, and it, obviously it's being used in that, but I think that this kind of visualization and being able to, what you're basically able to do is open this up, you're rotating it in real time, you can turn on and off the arteries, the veins, the muscles, the, you know, nervous system, the connective tissue, you know, all of these things are things that you can simply, you know, select and unselect and just see what all those pieces are. And as a learning, you know, tool, I think that it is, you know, we should be thinking about how this happens in education all the time, everywhere. You know, this is the kind of stuff, this is the beginning of that process. And so, and it's just a really, really well-made tool. It has quizzes and, you know, it has a lot of different ways to, you know, to look at these things. And so I think that there is, Anyway, I would definitely check it out. If you're interested in education and definitely in this area, but in general, I would take a look at it and possibly even think about buying it and playing with it. I don't know what I would need it for. It's not a tool that I would use other than we do a lot of education and a lot of visualization of education. And so I'm always researching this stuff. And it's just it's very, very well made and very stable for the kind of work that it's doing. I can't believe, you know, what it's rendering in real time. Anyway.
No, it looks unbelievable. Clayton, what do you have for us?
Well, I got one that's kind of selfish, and then I have another one here.
We like selfish. Selfish works.
Hey, you know, when you roll out a new app and you spend 8-9 months working on it, you got to be a little selfish, right? In fact, we just had an update that just launched for this past week. I think it came out 2 days ago, 3 days ago. It was approved. So my app, Read Quick, it's the world's first speed reading app for iOS. It allows you to both use the iPad and the iPhone, access your pocket lists, your Instapaper archive, and coming very, very, very soon, probably within 2 days, is readability we've added. So we've been working on that one and many, many more updates to come. Basically lets you speed read through your entire news feed and everything else that you can think of. We're working on other big updates that'll enable you to do some other big reading lists. We can't tell you exactly what they are just yet, but you know, right now it's your news. One word at a time on the screen, your comprehension will go up. You will see your comprehension and your speed. I love getting emails from users. Tell me if you get the app, email us at ReadQuick and tell me your reading rate, because people, they email and they say, I can't believe it. In 2 days, my reading rate has already doubled and they're just flying through their news. We launched it on iPhone about 3 weeks ago and it has been our biggest hit. I wish I would have launched it on iPhone first, because now, you know, you're standing in line at Starbucks. You can read that whole Business Week article in like a minute and a half instead of 15 minutes. So for those of you who like to life hack things, please check out Read Quick. It's a labor of love. We've got some big updates coming and some big announcements, hopefully very, very soon. So check that out. And if you have any questions about it, you can find me on Twitter as well, Clayton Morris. I'll answer your questions about it. And one other quick app. I love photography and I've been playing around with this. You know, one of the problems with if you have a DSLR or you have, like a Sony NEX7, you know, the GPS is not built in. And sure, you can buy like some little dongle and add it to the whole thing. But if you just want to get geotagging of your photos when you're traveling abroad or just here in the States or wherever you happen to be, and you get back and you realize, oh, my whole trip, it would have been nice to see where we were in that mountain range or along that river or at that museum and where in the city. And it's hard to figure it out using Google Maps sometimes, and you don't want to add that stuff later. There's a great app called Geotag Photos Pro for iOS. And basically on your iPhone, you create a new trip. You're going to the Adirondacks this weekend. You create a new trip and type in Adirondacks, and then you can set it to auto log, like leave a breadcrumb like every 2 or 3 minutes or however often you want, so that it knows where you are along the path. And then you sync with Dropbox. And you get back, if you're using Lightroom or Aperture, to your main computer. And you got to make sure on your SLR you have the proper time set in the clock settings, because it syncs between the clock settings. So it knows where you are according to the time. And then when you get back, it syncs through Dropbox. You just go into Lightroom and drag that one little file from Dropbox right into Lightroom. And all of your photos will have the geotag information from where you were on your trip. For a person like me who takes like 1,000 photos with my SLR, and you like to know where you were when you were in Portugal, it's a great app. I think it's like $1.99 or $3.99. I forget exactly. But Geotag Photos Pro, great little utility. $3.99.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. I had a lot of trouble coming with a pick of the week this week because so many apps updated for iOS 7, a few beforehand, a few afterhand, but on the day of iOS 7, on last Wednesday, it was just app after app after app. So I took the cowardly way out, and I'm picking Apple's iOS 7 designed for iOS 7 section, because these are people way smarter than me. It's Apple's app editorial team. They go through, they carefully pick out the apps that they think best represent the platform. And since they wrote the platform, they're entitled to do this. And they have a fantastic collection of apps. So if you've got iOS 7 on your device, especially if you have a new device and you're looking for something to really show off the new design language and all the new features, I mean, they've got the NBC app, OpenTable, OmniFocus 2 by the Omnic Group, Twitterific 5. A lot of people said Twitterific is already, it already looks like iOS 7. What else could they do? Turns out there was yet more things they could do. It's a gorgeous update. Runkeeper, even Facebook has updated. Facebook, who famously had basement sidebars on both sides of their app, has brought some sanity back to their social networking. Pcalc by James Thompson, fantastic developer, made a really nice looking theme. Shazam is updated. Pocket is updated. Pocket Cast and Instacast, no matter how you like to get your podcast, both of them have fantastic new versions of the app. Byword, it is literally, I mean, there's Perfect Weather, Reader 2. There is literally Instapaper. I can't stop naming apps. There are so many here that you will have an absolute joy using iOS 7 for weeks and months to come. And I imagine they'll keep coming. But this is a great place to start if you're looking for just those first few, right out the door, iOS 7 apps. Alex, I want to thank you for joining us. I know that you are probably in whatever the commando equivalent of video production mode is. What are you working on lately and where can people find you?
I am, best place to find me is probably G Plus and Twitter. So I'm just Alex Lindsay, both of them. And I don't really have a blog anymore. I just post ideas up on G Plus. And I think the most recent thing that we did that we can talk about, we do 5 or 6 events a week, but I can usually not say anything about them. But the one that we did a stream with Thomas Keller and William Sonoma. So if you go to William Sonoma's site on YouTube, we're pretty happy with it. It was great. I want to cook it, and I can tell you, it's really good. We were there on site, so we got to sample it when it was done. And so anyway, and Thomas Keller, of course, is from French Laundry, probably one of the top cooks in the world. And so anyway, I'd love to, get people's feedback on it and see what they thought of it. It's about a 1-hour live stream of how to cook lamb shanks. And so it was actually a lot of fun. And so that's what we've been working on that we can talk about. And we'll hopefully be able to talk about something here and there in the upcoming weeks. But where to find out what we're doing is, Twitter and obviously G+ are the two best places to find me.
And you've been sharing some of the things that you do for your Hangouts that I know myself and a lot of other people who do Hangouts found them enormously valuable. So thank you for that.
Yeah, every once in a while we get released. So I ask them, hey, I've got a couple followers. I can add a couple, maybe a couple people to the views if I can show some of the pictures. And so they let me take pictures of behind the scenes. So I think from that Thomas Keller one with William Sonoma, they let me put a couple of photos up. And so we try to do that whenever we're allowed to.
And Clayton had to jump off. He apologized, but he had an appointment he had to get to. You can find him at Clayton Morris on Twitter. You can find Read Quick on the App Store. And you can watch him every week on Fox and Friends. You can find me at Renee Ritchie on Twitter. You can find me at iMore. And you can find everyone on Mac Break Weekly and all the other fantastic Twitch shows at twit.tv. So for now, on behalf of Leo and Andy and Alex and Clayton and myself, get back to work. Mac Break is over.